This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Timothy Tyson is an award-winning writer and a historian. His books, Blood Done Sign My Name and The Blood of Emmett Till, capture something essential to American politics and culture, namely the toxic nature of our nation's unhealed racial wounds. Tim Tyson comes from a line of Methodist ministers who were not afraid to stand up for what they believed in, including his father, Reverend Vernon Tyson, who in the 1970s stood up after an all-white jury failed to convict the murderers of a black veteran. Reverend Tyson passed away recently at the age of 89. Tim Tyson joins us now to talk about the legacy of his father and his body of work that includes a memoir that was turned into a Hollywood movie. Tim Tyson, senior research scholar and at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, an adjunct professor of American Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Tim Tyson, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, Frank.
Very sorry to hear.
Thanks for having me here.
Sorry to hear about your father, too.
Well, thank you. He died in his bed, and he died in his sleep, and he died surrounded by his family. And he'd outlived his oldest sibling by 17 years and had a full and big and wonderful life of learning and love and good work. So
let's talk a little bit about that love and good work, what he learned along the way and was very humble about, how he was learning all along the way.
Always.
And yet doing work. The Reverend William Barber, who, of course, helped found the Moral Monday movement, said that your dad was like a father to him. And he is a father to you. Talk about his impact on you growing up, the effect he had on you as a young man.
Well, my father had five brothers, Dewey and Tommy and Earl and Bobby and Dewey. And they were all in Methodist ministers in Eastern North Carolina, and had a sister, Merle, too, and two sisters and a brother who died early. But that was not so unusual back then, but for a tenant farming family. But I grew up, they played spades, and I grew up, if you hid in the corner when they were playing spades and they sort of forgot you were there, they were funny, and they talked about church politics. And in those days, the only issue in the white church was race. And I knew, like, that's how you got in trouble if you were a preacher. And you had to walk the line and you wanted to preserve your influence and be a, people don't listen to you scolding them. But if they know that you love them and they know that you respect them, then they might hear you. So they were all trying to push the church toward seeing all God's children as equals.
Were they saying? Because it had to be an admixture of frustration, I would guess, but also strategy. I mean, did they talk about they might do this?
My father always said that being a dissident on race made him a better preacher. Because he wasn't going to be late for church and have his shoes muddy. He always said if the man that most wants to run you out of the church goes to see his mama at the nursing home, and every time he does, you just left, then it gets, what with mama and them, it gets a little tricky to get rid of you. He got amused a little bit because in later days he got seen as a civil rights activist when really he was a passionate follower of Jesus who just happened to start his ministry in 1952 in Oak Ridge. And he hadn't even preached yet when the man who was showing him around up at Oak Ridge, they pulled up behind a school bus. And the man said, now, Vernon, I know you young preachers may have some different thoughts on this, but this is not the time and this is not the place to talk about integration. So, of course, my father talked about integration, but not before he had a relationship with people.
Well, talk about that signal event in Oxford, North Carolina, the murder of Henry Morrow, 23-year-old black Army veteran.
Henry Morrow was a first cousin of Ben Chavis. Elizabeth Chavis was my father's friend and ally. Ben was 23. He had come home to teach chemistry at Mary Potter High School, which was the African-American high school there in the last years of segregation. And my boy that I played with virtually every day, told me that his father and his two brothers had killed this young black man for saying something at the store to his sister-in-law, Judy. And they had run him out of the store and shot him from behind about 150, 250 feet off their property. He had not touched anybody, and it's not even clear that it wasn't a misunderstanding, but he was perceived to have said something flirtatious to the young white woman at the counter. And then they came over and beat him with the stocks of the weapons and broke a shotgun stock over his head, and then just shot him through the middle of between his eyes, laying on the ground, begging for his life. This isn't a murder mystery. This happened in front of quite a few people. And, you know, in 1970, Martin Luther King had been assassinated 2 years before. And that whole sensibility of nonviolence was embattled, to say the least. Mm. And while, you know, Ben Chavis became the leader of a movement that was nonviolent and marched up out of First Baptist Church, there were a group of black veterans. And this,
because Henry Merrill was a veteran.
So one of their own had been murdered.
Yeah.
And then his killer is acquitted by an all-white jury. And they burned down the tobacco warehouses in Oxford, where, you know, as big as Cameron Indoor Stadium, full of tobacco, a known flammable substance. and those were big fires that you could see 20 miles away. And we were four blocks away. And so Oxford burned on in my memory forever. And I went back when I was a freshman in college and bought a tape recorder on the way up there and interviewed Robert Teal, who's the father of that family and who was really responsible for the murder, to talk to him about why he had killed Henry Mara and what did he think about it now. And that was the first oral history interview I ever did. Mm. That was the first historical research I ever did.
Because you're a 10-year-old boy at the time this is happening.
Yeah, I was 11, just 11, turned 11, I think.
And your father's at the center of this because he's trying to preach now. And this, obviously, the town, this is the only topic of conversation. These men are acquitted. They'd clearly murdered a man. And they, because of the way the penal system works in the South and under white supremacy, they were acquitted. But you're just a kid, and you're hearing all this kind of language, and people are sort of passing it on. You're absorbing the racism of the moment as a child, and then there's your dad in the pulpit who's got this job, and I'm wondering how you're and Blood Doesn't Sign My Name very much deals with the tension and sort of how you're coping with this as a young man and then grow through it. But take us to that moment.
Yeah, I saw how crazy this was. I didn't understand it at all. I knew a little bit about Martin Luther King. My father admired him greatly. And I had a image of the civil rights movement in my head that it was, you know, in that it was, you know, nonviolence, that it was, you know, pure bare-fanged evil versus good in, you know, in the streets of Birmingham. And somehow it was kind of morally pristine and had a, you know, unchallenged leadership in Martin Luther King. And I just wished somehow that I had been in a place that was less troubled, you know, in Oxford, like Birmingham, which is, of course, ridiculous. Right. But I remember going down to the corner. The Teals lived around the corner from us, and I saw the men with hoods and robes and rifles on his front porch. And then we had to move away. And so, being Methodist, the Methodists move in June, the Methodist preachers.
But
in those days,
why. Was it because of what he was preaching? Because of what he was saying? Or?
Well, my father told us that he had a new job, new church in Wilmington, and, you know, it was a great church, and did we know that Wilmington was near the beach? But because it was June, and it was still September before school started, I went back to Oxford and stayed with my friends Ben and Joy Averett on a farm. And when I got there, Ben stopped the truck in the driveway and said, "Now, you know, Joy's going to get y'all ready for church in the morning, but I just wanted you to know, you know, I won't be going with you. I told him if they fired your daddy, I would never set foot in that church again, and I'm not." Ben had been on the administrative board. Mm-hmm. So I got two mixed stories about that and heard a lot in Oxford because I stayed there a bit. In the summers, that was kind of my summer camp, going up to Ben and Joy's. And I got teased about my daddy getting run out of town and so on. It's a little murky.
What was he saying? I mean, again, he was a man who did understand.
He was mainly, you know, he was just talking about all of God's children being here on the same basis, and that we were sitting on 350 years of wrong, and that it was a keg of dynamite under our feet, and we had to deal with this, and it couldn't wait. It had waited too long, and we had to deal with this, and it was going to cause some painful change, but it was going to be good and good for everybody. That was about what he talked about. And of course, being daddy, he always talked this in terms of the scriptures. But
some of that painful change was also going on in Wilmington, North Carolina.
His next stop. It was out of the frying pan, into the fire. Frank.
Into the fire. We're going to talk about that fire and what happened next when I continue my conversation with historian and author Tim Tyson, senior research scholar at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke, adjunct professor of American Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And just ahead, we'll talk about Wilmington, the heat of racial violence, and much, much more on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, and I'm talking to Tim Tyson, noted local historian, author of The Blood of Emmett Till, and a memoir called Blood Done Sign My Name, that details racial unrest after an all-white jury failed to convict the murderers of a black man in Oxford, North Carolina. Tim Tyson's father, Reverend Vernon Tyson, was in the heat of that maelstrom, both in Oxford, North Carolina, and then they got a new congregation in Wilmington. Talk about the moment you arrived in Wilmington.
Well, we came across the bridge, and there was the battleship, and we saw an alligator in the water, and Wilmington was different. There was Spanish moss and all kinds. It was a sort of a different biosphere, and that was interesting. But we were just, Wilmington was just on the edge of full-blown integration, which happened there when I was in the seventh grade. And the African-American community had been very upset about the closing of the Williston High School, which was the black high school, and their pride and joy that they had really built themselves a long time ago. And so and then integration didn't happen. In a way, it didn't happen at all, because integration is blending two things together. But what they did was sort of snuff out this African-American educational tradition and then build a state-of-the-art high school for the white folks and then ship the black people out to it where they weren't welcome and didn't feel at home, and it was difficult. And then Wilmington had a group called the Rights of White People that met in Humacrae Park across the street from my junior high school with their Confederate flags and military weapons and a microphone, blasting hate and fear into our school and all over the city, for that matter. The Rights of White People had a storefront fort, essentially, downtown in the middle of the black community. And, 750 or so members, they had trucks and CB radios and patrolled the streets and shot at people. You know, and then there was a lot of arson going on.
It was a difficult time. What was it like for you in school? Because your school was nominally integrated, but as you say, people weren't really ready for it, and there was a lot of tension around it. So what was it like for you going to school every day?
Well, we had one or two black children at my school in the sixth grade, but when I went to the seventh grade, it was a full and unitary school system and we were integrated close to more like half and half. And that was we had riots. There were a lot of fights. But one thing that happened was I remember the assistant principal, Mr. Brandon, I don't know his first name, but he got some of us who were the most respected among our peers, people who were athletic or pretty or funny or, nice or whatever, the people he perceived as being sort of leaders of their and influential. And he got us in a room and talked to us about how we had to stop this business. And so we had assemblies every week, and we spoke to our classmates, and then we played music and sang together and held hands, the whole student body. And it really did calm things down at our school. And there were some really bright moments. There were, friendships that happened across that. And some of us were very proud, but it was to be a part of this but it was still really rough. And the next year we were at another school, it really was much rougher. And so, and it just seemed to me that grown-ups were crazy.
Well, you're
I didn't quite understand. And I wanted to know, when did all this get started anyway? Mm-hmm. What is the problem here?
And So you were curious in that moment, sort of how
well,
this
you thing. Had to be. I mean, or you if you were a, you know, I was kind of a bookworm and thought about things and really devout Christian too, and at the time, and I was I just wanted to know why we were at each other's throats, because I didn't feel that way. I mean, I know that I was, you know, neck deep in white supremacy without knowing it, and I'm not trying to say we were good white folks and we, you know, were perfect or anything or at all.
Well, did you wonder, but, because you what you're saying though, yeah. You said you had to be, but you didn't have to be. In fact, what most people do is accept the judgment and the cultural, you know, story that's passed down to them, and they know why it is. Their daddy told them why this is, and it's because those folks did thus and thus.
Well,
and then the question of white supremacy too, whether or not you understood that you were in some ways a part of this or apart from it or role in it or thought you had a role in it. Yeah.
I knew that there was a struggle going on and that we were part of it and that we were on the side of the movement. Hmm. Not that my father was in the movement exactly, but he and his brothers were all working to try to push the white church in a direction that was going to be helpful to making the change peaceful and making the change fruitful. And that was not an easy thing to do. And, you know, they got in some trouble.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my
mm-hmm.
Uncle Earl got run out of Lewisburg, and my Uncle Tommy had some pretty, I would say, safe to say he got run out of Goldsboro. And, you know, it was just all of them, as I said, when, you know, we were listening to them play spades, you realize that they were talking about how do you walk that line between a prophetic role, telling people what they need to hear, and a pastoral role where you're telling people, you're giving people comfort, and you're giving people community and connectedness, and yet trying to make that be about love and not about, seeing somebody outside of that circle as the other and us being us, you know, in some kind of negative way.
And you said that your father did that. One of the keys to this, as far as he was concerned, was building a relationship first, not coming in there and lecturing and listening to all parties. When you get to Wilmington, as you say, things were tense. And then eventually there was violence. And we know the story of the Wilmington 10. That was a story of the violence that surrounded the efforts to integrate. And your father tried to broker some peace in that moment, too. Talk us about his efforts and connections.
Well, he knew Ben Chavis, and Ben Chavis was portrayed in the media as being the firebrand, of black power, and a violent person, a dangerous person. Now, you know, the movement didn't have a command structure. Mm-hmm. You know, Martin Luther King had this trouble where the movement was nonviolent, but the people standing around the park across the street, you know, when they saw the people getting beaten and the fire hoses and the police dogs, they'd start throwing rocks and bottles at the police, you know, nonviolent rocks and bottles, of course. But, you know, but you couldn't.
Right,
Martin
right.
Luther King would say, right. you know, we'd go to the right. pool hall and say, you know, we know you're with us, but if you can't be nonviolent, don't come out. Mm-hmm. You know, I understand that myself, but please.
Right.
And, you know, Ben Chavis had a certain vision of things, but he was sitting in a powder keg, and the thing did blow. And they were actually one of the satisfying things about my work as a historian is that I was able to come up with, thanks to some friends of mine in Wilmington, come up with a box full of the prosecutor's papers in the Wilmington 10 trial that definitively proved that they were framed, that it was a racially motivated framing. It was in the handwriting of the prosecutor that they were railroaded and sent to prison. But Ben had a storefront church downtown, the Church of the Black Messiah, and you didn't go downtown. There were several people killed downtown,
This is in the midst of riots.
Right,
and then
you had the rights of white
killed,
people,
right.
and then this sort of black power movement downtown. And my father went down there, wore his ministerial collar so people could see that he was a preacher, and walked down the middle line of the road downtown so people could see him and see his hands, you know. And he walked down and went to see Ben Chavis to see if he could maybe help interpret Ben for the white community and get some communication going so that we could. And, you know, we had meetings at our church trying to get people to understand the historical moment that we were in, and that we didn't have to be at war with one another, but we did have to change.
Your father was on this show several years ago. We talked with him about that and about those meetings that he held, going into those churches and listening, and there were people, sort of black and white families that were invited in, no press, and trying to understand what was going on from the point of view of each community. And he had this moment that he shared with us that I think was so revealing. It was revealing to him, too, the humility of him to understand that he had just learned something in this moment. Let's listen to what he said a few years ago.
We met for several Sunday afternoons to talk to each other, black and white. And they kept talking about what had happened. And my folks, my white folks, were pressing the black people. What do you mean, what happened? You mean this integration business in the school? No. You mean this and that? No. Well, you all know what happened. Of course you know what happened. No, we don't. Tell us what happened. And one woman stood up and said, well, we understand that in 1898, this river out here was just chalked up with black bodies. That's what happened here. And that had poisoned our culture. Don't you see, Frank, we can be like a root out of dry ground. I'm told that there's some seeds that we found in Egypt 2,000 years old, been on shelves, that if you put them in the ground, some of them will sprout. And these hurts, unresolved things, are in us.
The clip from the late Reverend Vernon Tyson. We talked with him in December of 2006 on The State of Things. His son Tim Tyson is here. I'm sure that's very emotional for you to hear his voice now. He passed away in December. What a profound insight to have in that moment, that this 1898, I can't even remember if by 2006 we'd revealed now again another conspiracy that had been concealed for 100 years. It had been called the Race Riot of 1898, and it turns out it was the only successful coup d'etat organized by white supremacist Charles A. Koch, who was governor of North Carolina and chief of staff for Woodrow Wilson. and of course,
Aycock wasn't chief of staff for Woodrow Wilson. I think you're talking about Josephus Daniels, who was the publisher of the News and Observer, was the Secretary of the Navy for Woodrow Wilson. And Josephus Daniels and Charles Brantley Aycock and Furnival Simmons had really plotted out the white supremacy campaigns of 1898 and 1900 that overthrew the state government by force and by fraud, and then took the vote away from black citizens. No, the state government, Frank. The city government was a different matter, although they overthrew you have to understand 1897. You know, in the late 1890s, a black and white interracial political coalition called the Fusion Movement. Right. And that's why Reverend Barber and I are always talking about fusion politics in North Carolina, because we have political ancestors, black and white, who came together with a common sort of moral core and set of agreed upon goals. And that happened in the 1890s, swept the state legislature, won both U.S. Senate seats, the governor's race, never lost a statewide election. And they were overthrown by the conservatives by force. And paramilitary men called the Red Shirts guarding the polls, and a lot of violence went on. And then they took the vote away from black people, so that the large group of whites who had stood with in this interracial coalition, which, though imperfect, offered a different vision and a different kind of South in their vision, and the But those white folks had nowhere to go after that.
But we do talk about, when we talk about the violence of 1898, we are talking about, in that case, the city government of Wilmington, which had that fusion government, a black and white coalition, had won citywide office and were literally shot out of office.
Yeah, the Wilmington was the stronghold of the fusion movement. It was the largest city in North Carolina. It was, about half black and half white. And the city board had 6 white members and 4 African-American members, and they were all fusionists. And they were forced to resign at gunpoint. You know, they sat them down at a table with a rope and a pen and their resignation letter and banished the whites. Many, many black people were killed. We don't know how many by this mob. But that was just after the election, actually, when the conservatives have seized power. And the next governor's race, they elected Aycock governor. And then that was when Jim Crow came. I always thought it was slavery, and that was, of course, terrible. And then segregation, which was also bad. It wasn't as bad as slavery. And then in this shining arc of progress, you know, things got, we became free and equal citizens, at least in some legal sense. When really, you know, there was slavery, and then there was black citizenship, full black citizenship in the right after the Civil War, and that was put down by force and fraud. And then at the turn of the century, black and white people turned to each other in a difficult economic time and tried, the conservatives were backed by the railroads and the banks and the new manufacturing class, and were provided with state-of-the-art weapons. And that, so the white supremacy campaigns, which was, I'm not calling them white supremacists, that was what they called themselves, overthrew the state government, including the city of Wilmington. But that full story has never been told.
Right.
I've done my best.
And by 2006, again, I don't even think the full story, remember when the NNO came out with it, the fact that it had been known for over 100 years as a race riot in which, you know, events occurred and black people took to the street and then people were killed, and that's all we knew. And so now we're hearing that in African-American communities in Wilmington, that story had been told more properly, more correctly, and was palpable in the 1970s. It was still in the DNA of people. Yes. And
those
the white community
those
didn't
ghosts
even...
ghosts walked among us, sure. And the movement referred to them often, but white folks didn't know what they were talking about, as that piece that with Vernon showed so well. One thing that you need to know, though, is race riot. They call it the Wilmington race riot. Mm. The interpretation that you're talking about, people thinking about black people taking to the streets, destroying a lot of white-owned business property, that the way we think of race riot from the 60s. Actually, race riot at the turn of the century meant a white mob goes into the black community, shooting the place up, hanging people from lampposts. And, this was a pogrom in the Jewish tradition, it would be called, right? Just a genocidal massacre is what scholars call it. It's not genocide because they don't kill all the black people. Right. You just kill members of a group to terrorize the rest. And that was what race riot meant. You know, the Atlanta race riot of 1906, where actually North Carolina sent consultants to help them plan it. But there were a whole bunch of politically driven race riots in that part of this was the heyday, the birth of Jim Crow. Right. You know, all the segregation laws are passed in, between 1900 and 1910 or so.
And of course, there's no response from
the
federal
government.
This
is when black people lose the vote. No, the president didn't even say the word white supremacy campaign, North Carolina or Wilmington. They just acted like it hadn't even happened.
Which
and
gave
that
permission.
Was a green light for the rest of the South. And by 1910, every state in the South had disfranchised its black population, and often in a wave of violence.
That became the beginning of voter suppression, but sadly not the end of it.
Not at all.
But we're going to talk a little bit about the legacy of white supremacy and how that lives on today in the legislature here in North Carolina and elsewhere around the country, certainly in the White House now. But in terms of the way the scar that is not a scar, it's an open wound. I mean, this is something that you address regularly. And I think perhaps we don't understand it as an open wound. We do see it more like a scar, the scar of racism versus an open wound that is still bleeding and creating toxic effects today.
That's right, Frank. And one of the big problems is that we don't know who we are. We don't know where we came from. We still have that question that I had when I was 11 years old. How did this mess get started? And so we really don't can't imagine the history, most of us, that we've actually lived through. And if you're trying to change history and you're trying to make a better world, then you've got to know where you came from. And so that's really what moves me about teaching history and writing history.
We'll talk more about that journey, where it has taken you and where it might take you still. Tim Tyson, Senior Research Scholar at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, Adjunct Professor of American Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. There's more just ahead. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking to historian Tim Tyson, who spent a life writing stories of racial unrest about this country. His books, Blood Done Signed My Name and The Blood of Emmett Till, talking about your father's legacy and your curiosity about this and how it all got started. When did you decide that you were actually going to be a professional historian?
Well, I didn't even know there was such a thing, actually. I was, even through my undergraduate years, I was going to go to law school, and then I took a con law class, and though I liked it, I could see that that wasn't heading in my direction so much. And then I was tending the bar at Manuel's Tavern in Atlanta, and I began interviewing lawyers, of which there are many, at the bar, and I couldn't get anybody to tell me they liked it. So I went to talk to my history professor friend about it, and I had been going to see him for 3 years, and we had become great friends. He thought I was his protege. He said, I thought you were going to graduate school in history, you know, and I said, well, I can't do that. I've got $30,000 my undergrad degree, Dan. And he said, you don't have to pay to go to graduate school in the humanities. You'll get a fellowship. I'm like, what's that? And he said, well, you know, they pay your tuition and give you a little stipend. You know, you live on it, but barely. And so I applied real quick and came to Duke, where I worked with Bill Chafe and Larry Goodwin.
And then talk about Blood Done Signed My Name, the idea to go back and revisit those days.
I found when I moved here from Wisconsin, I was at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in the Department of Afro-American Studies for 10 years. That was my first academic job. But we moved back, and when we were moving, I found a spiral-bound notebook. It was in my handwriting, but it was the handwriting of a different day, maybe 15, and I was trying to tell the story of what had happened in Oxford. You know, it was two or three pages of writing. But when I was a freshman in college, I went to the library at UNC Greensboro, and I went in and started reading the newspapers. It was the first time I knew that you could read the newspaper for any day you wanted to at the library. They had all of these newspapers from way back. So I started reading the News Observer, and I went straight to May 11th and 12th, 1970, when Henry Morrow was murdered and the conflagration in my hometown started. And I read and read, and the next all day and all into the evening, and next thing I knew, the lights were blinking on and off, and it was time to go. So I went in the men's room and went into a stall and stood on the toilet and then lowered my head so you couldn't see my feet or my head. And they came in to check, you know, and they turned the lights off. And after 10 minutes when everybody was gone, I came back out and turned the machine. This was before, you know, security cameras and all that. And I just turned the machine back on and read until the janitor got there in the morning. But because I was so thirsty to know what had happened, and also grappling with what it meant, because I knew it wasn't just that place, that story, that somehow that if I understood that, I might understand all of it.
But you were living it. You heard all the gossip. You were there for the critiques and the threats and the fear. So what was it that the News and Observer, those objective accounts all those years later, did for you to keep you in the stall of the library?
The News and Observer's coverage was pretty good. Yeah. But it was also, there's something about seeing the documents of the time. Mm-hmm. You know, so you go to the governor's papers and you see the letters yourself. You see the State Bureau of Investigation report. You see, you know, the Highway Patrol reports. And it takes you a different level of reality. Then it's not just a story anymore, but it's something real that you can, you know, you have to ask yourself, what kind of world is it that this happens in? And so you have to know, you want to know all you can about that world so you can make it somehow make sense. And, of course, it always ties to today. Because the historian's day is always double. There's the day that you're researching, and which you're actually going through it and finding all this stuff, but you're imagining that world. It is a work of the imagination in addition to, it's just a work of the informed imagination. And then there's the day that you're living in. And so these things are always connected, and your life today affects the way you see the past. And the past makes you better able to understand the day that you're living in.
So what new understandings did all of that give you?
Well, I came, you know, Lord have mercy. Well, for one thing, there's African-American struggle, you know, story of resistance, you know, and I learned, and from going to up to Oxford and interviewing Eddie McCoy, for example, who was the head of the NAACP, but back in the day, he was a street guy. His dad owned McCoy's Pool Hall, and that was where the people who made the gasoline bombs that burned downtown Oxford, that burned the warehouses, made those gasoline bombs in the back room at McCoy's Pool Hall. I'm sure Eddie wasn't there, of course, but he was the ringleader of sort of the street guys in Oxford. And then I talked to other, you know, people who were more school teachers and people who were trying to negotiate with white people. But, you know, the street people, you know, Eddie would say, you know, we knew there wasn't going to, that these guys weren't going to be convicted. We knew there wasn't going to be a real trial. They had no expectation of justice, and they were just that was just revenge, and also a strategy in the sense that they knew that if they cost white people enough money, that they would have a seat at the table, that the negotiation would occur if they had cost enough money. That was the strategic piece of it, but some of it was just anger and rage, and it helped me to see that this was about a struggle for freedom and dignity, but it wasn't a perfect struggle. It wasn't a pristine, you know, it wasn't some kind of a cotton candy, sugar-coated struggle. It was a struggle just like the ones that were going on around me and the ones that we're seeing today.
Well, it also talks about the context, because all of that rage, all of that injustice, an American penal system that would never convict a white man of killing a black man ever and hadn't, those stories had been going on for decades. This was the moment in which street people like Eddie and others said, we're going to burn down there. Because it was always true that if we cost them enough, we might get a seat at the table. But it was also true that in the meantime, it's going to cost you plenty in return. And so there was something about this moment that made it right to actually burn those warehouses.
Well, you know, though, this goes back to the politics of the slave revolt. You know, masters knew full well if they beat slaves, you know, beyond any kind of expectation where the slave community couldn't stand it, you know, in the middle of the night on a stormy night, that barn could just catch fire. You know,
right?
And that bomb.
Yeah. So there was this agreement.
That happened.
There were these thresholds and boundaries.
Mostly American history has been a river of innocent blood, the blood of African Americans, in this murderous system for which, violence was just an inevitable byproduct of the social system, the racial caste system, and it took violence to maintain that system. And so, you know, there were always black people who fought back, defended themselves, and sometimes stuff caught fire. So that's not they weren't the first. But
this case in Oxford obviously had many resonances with the Emmett Till case. You decided to go back and revisit that case and do some interviews that turned out to be pretty significant. Talk about your decision, first of all, to look at the case of Emmett Till.
Well, I didn't have much interest in doing that, but I got a call from a nice lady in Raleigh who wanted to tell me how much she had liked Blood Doesn't Sign My Name. And, you know, Mama said be sweet, and I was just and I was grateful for that, like I am, but I don't really want to have that conversation for long. So I was getting off the phone, and she said, well, now, you know, I wanted to tell you that I gave the book to my mother-in-law, and it's her favorite book. And she's going to be up here next week, and we were hoping we could have a cup of coffee with you. And I just pretended she hadn't said it and kept on being sweet and polite and getting off the phone. And when she kind of heard that in my voice, she said, you might know about my mother-in-law. Her name was Carolyn Bryant. And of course, you know, like anybody in my line of work, I knew that Carolyn Bryant was the white woman at the store counter in the story of Emmett Till, in whose name Emmett Till was lynched. And, I also knew that she had never given an interview to anyone, that journalists and historians had been trying to talk to her for 60 years and no one had ever been able to. And here she wanted to talk to me, and they wanted she and her daughter, they mentioned interviewing her. So I really thought, well, yeah, I believe I could work that into my schedule. But and I thought just as a historian, it was my job to do that and put it in the archive so that some other historian eventually, you know, would bless my name because that would be in there and it would be the only one. But I wasn't going to write a book. But everybody thinks we know that story. But when I went to the library to research it, just to prepare for the interview, just a little research, I realized there was only one history of it, and it was a flimsy little book, just very short, not much research in it. We all know it because it's in textbooks and it's in which aren't researched really. And most of that was based on journalism. William Bradford Huey's story in Look magazine back in 1956, in which the murderers told about killing Emmett Till for pay. They had to tell the story to get the thousands of dollars from Look magazine. But that's where we knew the story. But that was the story of the people who murdered him. And there's scarcely a true word in it. But, you know, so I went back and did all this, you know, 7 years of research all over the country. And after I had talked to Carolyn Bryant, I felt it was important. And
Tell us what she told you, because I think that's significant. She had not done an interview, and now you hear that she, in fact, perjured herself.
Well, that didn't surprise me at all. In court, she testified. There's sort of a narrative where people say she lied and Emmett Till died, and that's not really true. The lie is really in court, you know, 5 or 6 weeks later. Told the story sort of the Black Beast rapist and the white Southern Lily, which was an old story that everybody knew. But that was not, I had the notes that her lawyer took when he interviewed her at the start. And she never mentioned in that account that he had even touched her. He had insulted her was the word and often that was code in the white South. If a black man insulted you, that kind of insinuated that there might have been something sexual about it. Didn't really say so, but he did not say anything about anything physical or sexual. And the account she told in court was, you know, a lie. But the jury didn't even hear it, and nothing would have convicted those men. She was, you know, trying to make sure her husband and brother-in-law got acquitted for sure. And that's, you know, that was evil and pernicious. But, nobody believed her. So to me, I was really surprised when people were so taken with the notion that she had perjured herself. And did anyone really think she was telling the truth? I never saw any indication that anybody did.
Well, then I think that gets to really the underside of this whole story and maybe a little bit of the question you've always asked yourself, which is maybe not how did this get started, but how is it perpetuated? Everybody knew they were guilty. Everybody knew it was a murder. Those jurors knew that a murder had been committed. And in fact, what's interesting is when those murderers told the story to Look magazine and boasted about it, the community turned their back on them because you're not supposed to tell. You can do this stuff, but you're not supposed to tell because we're trying to tell folks we're Christian and you're showing them we're not. So don't do that. So the whole notion that that there's this unspoken lie that everybody gets but nobody wants to reveal is to me the one of the most fascinating elements of white supremacy.
We see lynching is when a group of people kill somebody in the name of the community. That's what makes it a lynching. It's a group murder, and it's done and is justified in the language of standing up for the values of this community. In this case, white supremacy. In that their interview, they talked about school integration and black voting. They weren't going to live in a community where black people could vote. They weren't going to have black people choosing their leaders. They weren't going to have their kids going to school with black kids. They weren't going to have their women folk working side by side with black people in the workplace. So they were poor whites and they all worked. But anyway, that's the language in which they justified what happened. In the case of in Oxford, 15 years later, That is the all-white jury, essentially, that was a protest verdict against school integration. That had nothing to do with who killed who and whose fault it was. That stuff was plain enough. But it was people, I guess that's sort of a late model lynching. I call it was post facto because they were approving of the murder after it had happened in the name of a community that was going to resist integration. Yeah. And the sexual piece of that in both cases, that was the notion of the black man as the rapist and white womanhood, protecting white womanhood. This came from the turn of the century. That was a political story cooked up by Josephus Daniels William Brantley Aycock and Furnifold Simmons. That was the heart of the white supremacy campaign's propaganda. And what people didn't even know, when I was arguing with kids in high school, in junior high, about race, if you argued with the segregationists, their whole card was they would say, well, I guess you want your sister to marry one then, huh? You want your daughter to marry one? That would be all right with you, I guess, huh? And that was supposed to shut you right up because that was so horrible and unimaginable and this pornographic, vile notion that they, way they would imagine that, not two people might love each other, for example, but this kind of demonic thing almost. Well, that goes back to, slavery. That was that's how a racialized system of slavery was invented by changing English common law, so that rather than the status of this of a person following their father, John's son, Tice's son, right? It followed the mother. Because if status followed the father, then when a white man had sex with his enslaved African, quote, Mr. property, unquote, then the offspring would be, brownish, but free and white. The whole system depended on making that interracial sexuality a one-way street, but people didn't even know, why they felt the way they felt.
Tim Tyson, senior research scholar at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke, adjunct professor at UNC Chapel Hill, author of Blood Don't Sign My Name. Tim, always a pleasure, and we always run out of time too soon. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Frank. Good to talk to you again. Good to see you.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.